So today, the title of my discussion with you is, I've got nothing. I didn't know that expression before. I started seeing it appear on TV shows at one point. In English, when somebody's arguing with someone else or just saying something to someone else, and then the other person wants to reply, but then they say, I got nothing, meaning they have nothing they could possibly say. So this morning I was thinking, I've got nothing. So naturally, the first thing anybody would say when they hear me say that is, then why are you here even if you got nothing? I mean, you got nothing to give us. What's the point of you being here, sir? So then the question is, do I really have nothing? Is it possible to have nothing? So yesterday I was at a meeting at the BI in Gainesville, and we were discussing about presenting the Srimad Bhagavatam up to the point of presenting called cosmogenesis, the origin of creation. And the people who were doing the research of doing all these presentations from Mayapur were doing a great job. The discussion was with these people who did a really good job of presenting the way in which the scientific exhibition part of the Mayapur temple would be presented. But then we get to the point where they had been presenting everything with logic and reason and making it very reasonable for everybody. But then we get to a point where that doesn't work anymore. I mean, what person in existence understands the origin of all things? Even Lord Brahma said he doesn't understand it. So at one point there's going to be a line beyond which logic and reason cannot enter. And beyond that line, I got nothing. I cannot say it's like this. I can say the Bhagavatam describes it like this. And it's interesting, when you're presenting something even very scientifically and you're going through all the stages, at one point, you have to let reason and logic and expectations go. How do you make sense of Mahavishnu and all of these universal bubbles floating away from him? How do you make sense of that? How do you make sense of Krishna's rasa dance? How do you make sense of the rope Mother Yasoda is using to bind Krishna? How do you make sense of Krishna holding Govardhan Hill? So at that point, we got nothing. Well, then the question arises, are we just believing these things? Is it pure faith? Well, maybe and maybe not. How did we get to the point where we could believe without rupturing our brains and going tilt that Mahavishnu is the source of all the universal creation? We're not stupid people. We're not people who have no logic and reason at our disposal. We know how to understand things. And because of this, we can safely say we have arrived at our understanding of the theology behind all existence with our feet firmly on the ground. And the process depends on opening the awareness, opening mind, intellect, opening that capacity we have to know. So therefore, the statement, I got nothing, is very relevant. This doesn't arise from my intellectual process, this knowledge. It arises by accepting what is. It doesn't matter if anybody else understands it or if they believe it. This is not the point. Our point is what we understand, what we actually know, what we experience. We cannot receive this understanding if our intellectual existence or our experiential existence that relates to knowledge and knowing and consciousness is filled with our own ideas. So our own ideas block this perception of the greater awareness that is there everywhere in existence. We just don't see it. So to get to the point where you're qualified to understand this spiritual original existence, you have to embrace, I got nothing. Now, I don't know if you remember long ago when we started developing this technique of accepting the energy of the deity and sending our energy to the deity and then meeting in the middle, that loving energy. If you remember that experience at that time in St. Petersburg, you will understand very much more what I'm talking about. It took a long time of introducing all of the things that are blocking us, all of the things which are conditioning our understanding to get to that point. A practical example, let's say that you wish to become more aware of, I don't know what, nature. And if when you are attempting to experience nature, if you have a conception that this is Maya, you cannot experience it. So the ability to experience is very much limited to the way in which you approach the experience. If your experience is blocked, if you have any forms of conceptions, preconceived ideas, you're carrying a burden. And so when I say, I've got nothing, that's a very good thing. It means I'm not carrying anything with me. I'm not embracing any burdening things which block pure perception and awareness. So when we get to the point where we're going to talk about Mahavishnu, we're not even anywhere near Krishna as the source. We're just going to talk about Mahavishnu. You cross a line whereby you must absolutely suspend preconception. What I explained yesterday was that we have nothing to worry about that because nobody else has an idea. They have some theories, but no one else has any conception where they can say, this is it, and anything else is wrong. Like 2 and 2 is 4, you don't argue with it. But when it comes to this, no one can say it is so with realization of experience. So we don't have to feel in any way that we are somehow intellectually not up to par, or we're just dealing with belief, or we're just dealing with something that is, you know, theological and has no connection to reality, because no one else has any connection to it either. So all they, you know, with the quotes, air quotes, they got is, it's not so. That's all they got. Or it can't be that way. But this is not an argument. This is something like what children would argue in a playground. It is so. It is not so. It is so. It is not so. So it's either, yes, there is God. He's the source of all things. Or no, there isn't. It's just all material. It's a very simple dichotomy. It's not that one is terrible and one is better from the point of view of logic and reason. Neither have an answer that fits within anybody's definition of logic and reason. When you go beyond that line into the origin of existence. So when I say I got nothing, that is the prerequisite for getting something. So what is it that we get? Here's another interesting twist on that, leaving aside materialism and just simply speaking within the realm of devotees or devotional ideas. To have faith in the literature, in the Shastra, is a good thing. But what are you having faith in? There are so many things in our Shastra which no one can understand. It requires acceptance. Now, some people just accept everything. They don't even care, whatever it is, it is. They tend towards the fundamentalist kind of camp. It is stated with these words like this, and that is all there is, and there's no discussion. That's fundamentalism. Then you have those who understand that exactly what words they're reading may not fit exactly in the image that we receive from those words. Brahmanas have been arguing about the Shastra for thousands of years. That doesn't mean there's a better way to understand. There's not a better way to understand. Doesn't mean that. I only said that to demonstrate that words can and do mean different things to different people at different times. So when we stood before the deities in St. Petersburg, I embraced. I got nothing. I'm carrying nothing into this experience. When I say carrying nothing, I mean nothing that is not inherent in me or in the deity. I set aside all these material conceptions. It doesn't mean they're all gone. It means they're set aside, not relevant. I still require all this stuff to live. Without it, I don't live. But when I'm there, about to experience with the deities, these things are not relevant. And that includes all kinds of social expectations or demands or ideals or ideas that are placed upon me. Like, for example, I'm not good enough to do this. So I just let it go. And when I am there, I have a faith. I have a belief, even if not yet the experience. I have a faith, I have a belief that here in front of me is this spiritual energy, this spiritual power, and because I can feel, I can experience it. Well, wow, all of a sudden we have prerequisites here which are not insignificant. I've got to be able to feel. And I have to know that there's something to feel. To get to these two prerequisites, not easy. Takes quite some effort. A lot of people don't know how to feel. They feel stuff, but they don't know how to feel. They don't have that awareness that is relating to the feeling. Especially, now I shall feel this. And this feeling of the deity, of the power, of the spiritual origin, reflection of all that is, this feeling is unlocked when we let go of all the doors which we have placed, all the obstacles we have placed in front of that feeling. And when we are in such a state and we just feel, we know it's so. If somebody is not able to do that and they try to do that, they will not feel, they will not have faith. They will think, if they are devotees anyway, that they have faith in the deity, they will just think that they will not have faith in themselves. But feeling requires both the feeler and that which is felt. So in the case of somebody who can't feel, that which is felt, sure, they may have faith in, but they don't have faith in themselves. So the feeler is not there. So the experience is not there. So they have no faith or no capacity to enter into the exchange. So when they have this idea, they can't do it, they're not qualified, they're not good enough, they are possessing these negative energies. So they cannot have the concept of I've got nothing. They've got something, and that's the problem. I'm talking about that thing, whatever the something is anything that is born of this realm of the, call it if you will, illusory energy. Illusory energy is a great term, because just like this idea, I'm not good enough, that is definitely illusory, because everybody's good enough by their very definition. And then there's another illusion we can throw in here, which is a lot of fun. The illusion that you first have to become good enough, then you can make the connection. But if you first just get rid of the conception, then the connection can be made. Without even having to become good enough, you just get rid of the idea that you're not. And then you just accept the energy of the Lord, and you have this experience. And all of a sudden, you understand, yes, that's what the faith is all about. That's what the belief is all about. That's what spirituality is all about. You taste it. Our deities in St. Petersburg are tuned exactly to this experience. I have never met any deities before who are so tuned to this experience, so ready to make that connection. And when you make that connection, you no longer worry about having to justify how Mahavishnu could even exist. You are directly experiencing how you are intimately connected. You are intimately related as the particle and wave at the same time. You are quantum related on that spiritual wave of spirituality with Krishna. And how Krishna manifests this realm within which we are living under the influence of illusion, as we like, becomes not even an important issue to us. It just is, and we feel it. We can feel it through nature. We are seeing Krishna behind it all. We are experiencing that. It changes your perception entirely. So embrace the fact that we got nothing, and then embrace everything. What do we have to lose? And then what limit is there to the gain? So with these words, I stop there, and we can take a break, and you can put questions in the chat, and we'll get to them when I get back. All right, we're back. What is the reason that many people stop feeling contact with Krishna or other deities? If it's because they or we start to think we're not good enough, why is this happening? Or why do we enter into this experience? Well, this question starts off with, what is the reason that many people stop feeling contact with Krishna or other deities? Now, when they say many people, who are they referring to? Are they referring to somebody who once had contact, like a devotee, and then stopped feeling contact? Or are they referring to the fact that we once were with Krishna and then we stopped? Because there's a big difference between the two. Now, let's say, if we're just talking about regular folks who are here in this world and don't have contact with Krishna, but who we assume originally did have contact, I have proposed before in the past that the dominant factor in any such disconnection is the feeling of not good enough. No, just continue. And if it's the other one, where somebody was connected to Krishna and then decided to break that connection or no longer have that connection, then, yes, definitely feeling not good enough is a major factor, or there's shame, or there's frustration. So there's a clarification here. Let's hear it. Once upon a time they were, then they stopped being. But once upon a time, we're talking origin stories. So how do we get here? Perfect answer to that I don't have, but I propose that due to this feeling of not good enough. Now, the question then becomes, well, why did somebody who had spiritual connection feel not good enough? That's a tougher one to get involved in. as I've said it multiple times, I only like to speak about things I have experience of. And so I don't have an experience that I may draw upon to answer this question. But I have seen the effect of feeling not good enough for many, many years, seeing it in all kinds of ways, with all kinds of people, in all kinds of situations, and I know its power. And I've seen that the relationship between not good enough and shame and guilt or anger and other things are very much related. Just like, for example, if I find myself to be a complete useless waste of time, I suck. That creates a feeling within me that I'm not good enough, that draws on that feeling, but it amplifies that feeling I'm not good enough, and it creates within me this incredible negativity, this negativity of the self, that this negativity of the self fuels disconnection, because you cannot have that. You're carrying this baggage, and that means you cannot connect with the Lord because you have this baggage which is blocking you. So I think that my addressing of this topic is more or less complete, even though you could make a whole book about it. Okay, here, the number two is not really a question, but it's a statement. And I think it's worth reading. So I'll do that, and then Maha, you can read it in Russian. Thank you so much for such an important topic. I've been thinking for a long time exactly in the same way as you say, and I thought that everything that is written in the Shastras is practically incomprehensible to the ordinary mind. And when you read the Shastras, many more questions arise than answers. Oddly enough, just today, while conducting a program in our St. Petersburg temple, we were just discussing these questions about the incomprehensible huge layer of information from the Shastras concerning the gods and Almighty. People tend to down to earth and humanize everything because they have no other experience. For example, how to imagine Lord Nrsingadev, the place in which he lives, even the demon Hiranyakashipu, and the battles that take place between gods and demons, because they use such advanced weapons that is impossible to even imagine. To be honest, I avoid listening to these stories, although I really like reading the Shastras. Once again, thank you very much. Now, that's bringing up an interesting point. Now, should we accept Shastra as history? Is that its main purpose? History, to give us historical events that we can read. But one of the most interesting things about history is that nobody ever learns from history. Societies make the same mistakes, people do the same things, just with different names, at different times, different circumstances, and they always say, now it's different, this time it's different. So learning from history is a tough thing. So to simply, or to say that the Shastra is history and we should learn from it, not a very good idea. So what could we take from Lord Nrsingadev and this Hiranyakashipu conflict? Well, we can take all about Prahlad Maharaj, who he is, his mood, his understanding, his feeling, his surrender. That's the point to take. So many of the things in the Shastra are meant for us to take from the personalities there, how they underwent struggle, how they resolved their struggle, how they surrendered to the Lord, how they interacted with the Lord or served. These are the important themes, not just history. So from this point of view, the Shastra gains another kind of significance that allows us to read all of these events and all of these situations with a more open mind, with a more feeling the real intensity of the interactions between the individuals. Okay, question three. Whoa, this is a big one. Where exactly is Krishna at this moment? And where are we? Given that there is no time and space, can we exist separately from him for a moment, even if we want to? Well, wait a minute. Who says there's no time and space? If there was no time and space, you wouldn't know to come here for this lecture on this address. So time and space definitely exist. You are the proof. Now the question is, how does time and space limit Krishna? Well, the answer is obvious. Time and space do not limit Krishna. Krishna is the source of all time and space. Kalosmi, time I am. There you go. Well, we all exist in time. So we all exist within Krishna. All things exist within Krishna. Yet the question is, can we exist separately, even for a moment, even if we want to? Well, that question has two levels to it. The reality of the situation from the point of view of the Absolute looking towards us, and the reality of the situation from us looking outwards. From Krishna's point of view, no, we cannot exist separately. So we are actually never separate. From our point of view, we can declare ourselves separate or not even care. Don't even bother with the question. We are just who we are. So the question is, can we exist separately? Well, sure, in our minds, in our awareness, we can exist that way, sure. We're not actually that way in the total picture, but in our little itsy-bitsy space, in time and space, sure we can. We can pretend, or we can even actually believe it. Okay, question four. Often due to its own traumas, society can consider someone not good enough. How to resist such negativity? Yeah, I mean, that is one of the problems with society. And here's where society never learns from history, that almost always society gets it wrong in one way or another, or thousands of ways. But present society always thinks they've got it right. So from the societal point of view, the way we integrate into that understanding is very much related to our awareness. If we are aware of what is happening within society with all its various forms of negativity and misunderstanding about individuals, then we do not accept that. And that's how, from a societal point of view, we resist the negativity. We just don't accept it because we know better. But what if it's focused on you? I've been in that situation. And resisting negativity, well, do you have to? There's two situations here. One where a social group considers you to be in some way bad. If they restrict your capacity to act, that's one thing. But if you feel bad that they make you feel bad, if you feel bad that they think you're bad, that's another thing. If the negativity is restricting you in some manner, then you have to use the various tools available to you, which you use at any time when you're facing obstacles. That's just bread and butter acting in this world, nothing special. But if you are feeling bad that they think you're bad, then you have embraced their idea about you. That's a totally different situation. And dealing with that requires psychological understanding. It requires emotional intelligence. It requires a lot of experience to understand that just because somebody thinks of you in some way, that does not define you. But if you actually are guilty, meaning you actually did something bad that society has you for, you know, you're really a convicted bad guy. That's again another situation. Because on one hand, you've got to rectify what you did wrong by paying the price. And on the other hand, you've got to learn from that and make changes in the way you act or the way you think. Okay, so question number 5. Would it be correct to say that assuming the role of being observed instead of being the observer helps to understand this important point that we've got nothing? Well, I would say that's an interesting technique to add to your arsenal of relationship, for example, with the deity. Because it's one thing to go before the deity and just observe, like you're seeing the deities with their flowers and their clothes, and you're seeing the way the pujaris are acting. That's just very simple. But it's much more sophisticated and advanced and aware when you come before the deity that they are perceiving you. When you go and you just observe the way the altar is and everything, you can hide behind that. You can hide in such a way that you are just, you're just here to look. They are doing their thing. But when you are being observed, it's a whole nother thing, because there's that personality there that is observing you. That is very heavy. And that requires a very deep understanding of spiritual awareness of who the deity is. So as a technique, just an experience, but I'm using the word technique perhaps wrongly, but as a methodology by which we can increase our understanding of the deity, understanding that we are the observed is a very good mentality to do that. That's a good point. Number 6, personality manifests when an individual has a personal opinion without submitting to the general trend. Yes, that's a very good statement, because obviously if you have an opinion, that opinion is very much born from your personality. Because after all, an opinion is extremely subjective. It's kind of like, I think, whatever, that's an opinion. I like this, I don't like that, this stinks, this is great, this is an opinion. And every one of these statements is representing our personal taste. Even more importantly is the choices we make. The choices we make are our conclusions of what we want. Our choices are very much interrelated with our desire, and desire is the basis of personality. But that doesn't mean we'll always get what we want. We may be stuck into doing something because we have no choice, but still we have to make a choice. You can't do nothing in almost all cases. Even in the Gita, no one can avoid doing anything, even for a moment. You're always doing something. And the idea in this question is that when one holds that personal opinion with integrity, our own integrity, we do not submit to the general trend of existence. We do not submit to the whims of society. And that is very much related with personal integrity, which is actually integral to personality. That personal integrity also protects and nurtures personality. So that's an interesting topic. Number 7, some people think that the goal of life is to become a slave of the Lord. Maybe the Lord wants his children to become his slaves. And in general, what the Lord expects from people. Well, I know some people think that way, but is it so? I mean, after all, just take anybody walking down the street. In what way are they serving God right now as a slave? So if we're talking about people in general, well then no, they all have the freedom to do whatever they want. I mean, not necessarily the ability to do whatever they want, because they're restricted in so many ways, but they have that freedom to choose. But maybe you're talking about devotees or those who have devotion to God. Any religious personality who's actually dedicated themselves to God. Well, let's talk about this for a second. The difference between a slave and the difference between somebody who is dedicating themselves to God. A slave has no choice. A slave is told what to do. And if a slave doesn't do it, they're punished. Someone with a free desire to render service to God figures out how to do that in the best way they can. And they are continually updating that choice as time goes on. And they're not punished if they do something different or they don't do something one day. Now, obviously, Krishna would rather have those acting for his service out of free will and desire. And do you really feel that Krishna would want a slave? That is a very heavy situation. I don't believe that in any way. Okay, number 8. If there is time and space, and at the same time we are constantly in relationship with Krishna, then where are we now at this moment? Now, it seems to me that time is part of Maya, which shows that we are separate from Krishna. Gee, wow, that's like an insanely cosmic question. Oh my God, I would not even know how to dive into that. That's huge. The huge part is, where are we now at this moment? Okay, let's just give a kind of obvious answer first and see if we get away with it. The obvious answer would be that we're within Krishna, connected to Krishna, working within Krishna's energy of time and space for the benefit of Krishna, meaning that we use this time and space for the benefit of Krishna. So we are right here, right now, doing that. Obvious answer. Now, the idea that time is part of Maya. Well, I would rather rephrase that because I don't think that's exactly representative. Now, Krishna says, time I am. But in the eternal world, time equals existence. Here in this world, time equals transformation. Things are changing and moving throughout time. And that which used to be is in the past. So that is definitely Maya. But just because we are in a different place, because time no longer, we're going to include that in this talk right now. Just because we're in a different place where our perception of time is different does not mean we are separate from Krishna. So when you're in that spiritual existence, time is Krishna's energy. In other words, you are feeling Krishna. That is the manifestation of time. So you're perceiving it that way, that time is Krishna, because time is existence. That is the existence you are in. That's how you perceive it. But in this realm, our perception is that time is constantly clicking and it's moving. Now, within that movement, we can have experiences which transcend that time perception. For example, when we're connected with the deities, time fades away. But it doesn't disappear because at one point we have to stop. But that does not mean we're separate from Krishna, because at that time we're very much connected to Krishna. Even when we stop, we're still connected. It's just we're in a different form of perception of it. But another way to look at this question is the way time is manifesting in this world. Like, Krishna is time, yes, but everything is destroyed in time, if we continue with the statement. So this realm is very much related to the onward motion and destruction of all things via time. So when we're embracing that destructive energy, How we perceive Krishna's role within it means everything. So that does not necessarily mean we're separate. It's a question of the perception, a question of our intention. But that time definitely is integrally connected with the illusion, for sure. Because Krishna is causing that to be one of the most, the most significant feature of the illusion. And that being in that illusion is the fundamental function of the separation with Krishna, from Krishna. So yes, it's so. So I'm not sure that was the answer you were looking for, but that's all I've got. We try our best here. Okay, so I think I'll stop there. And I hope that you're all well and that you're happy in your lives and that all success comes to you. And I wish you all good things.